For some people, the Vietnam War isn't over. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tim O'Brien fought in Vietnam, then wrote about his experiences. He doesn't expect President Obama's Vietnam visit will bring closure for everyone.
For every dead or wounded veteran, there's a mother out there somewhere in Florida or Mississippi who 45 years after the war, it hasn't ended for her.
After Vietnam, the president heads to Hiroshima, a place with its own dark history. But politicians here and in Japan don't like going there.
They are not revisiting history. They are making a symbolic statement, which is meaningful, about the hopes or prospects or policies for a non-nuclear future.
Those stories coming up on The World. We've got a lot on the show for you today, including a great interview with Tim O'Brien and Phil Clay, two writers who once served in the armed forces in Vietnam and Iraq. With President Obama in Vietnam this week, I asked Tim and Phil for their thoughts on that visit by the man who brought troops home from Iraq. That's coming up later on the show. We begin, though, with an update on a different story, one we've been following for a while, refugees and the dismantling of the migrant camp in Idomeni in Greece. Today, Greek authorities began bulldozing the camp, which is near the border with Macedonia. Thousands of people have been staying there in recent months. Now those migrants are being forced to relocate to a more permanent camp. Jean Carstensen has reported for us from Idomeni. Today, she says journalists were not allowed to get very close to the camp.
But I was able to see around the perimeter and see all the police. You can see many, many riot police around the perimeter of the camp. And I could see many of the buses that have been arriving all day. The main point of all of this is to get the people out of this camp by moving them to official camps elsewhere in Greece. So they're being taken away in these buses, and they hope to have this done within about a week or two.
I know, since you were at a distance, hard to say, but were you able to get a read on some of the moods and emotions of the people who were getting on these buses?
It's hard to tell at the distance. I certainly know there hasn't been violence, and everybody is very thankful for that. But I can tell you, in my days reporting in the last week, I've spent a lot of time with refugees, and I got a sense of the place as a bit of a village, and the conditions were very poor indeed, but people were nonetheless able to form communities. And many people I spoke to said they just didn't want to go to one of these government-sanctioned camps. They preferred to stay where they were. And I sort of got the feeling that Idomeni had become a symbol for a lot of people of hope that the original dream they had of safety when they left their war-torn countries and that they would be welcomed by Europe. Idomeni is the last place where they can hold on to that hope. I also think they want to be safe, and many families especially are going to go wherever will be safest for their children. But nonetheless, I know that many of the people there are not happy about going.
Well, I mean, a lot's at stake because, as you told us earlier this week, some of these people are starting to contemplate going back to the war-torn situations they came from in Syria, in Iraq. So with the demolition of this camp, what's next for them?
Well, I think what's next for most of them is getting, hopefully, registered so that they can apply for asylum in Greece or for relocation if they qualify into other European countries or for family reunification. I think one of the biggest disgraces of this whole process has been these refugees that were trapped when the border closed and the policies changed. They were promised access to these programs and swift, fair, individual assessment of their cases. And the vast majority of these refugees have not even spoken to anybody about what their case is and why they're here, why they're applying for asylum. So honestly, I think for most of them, hopefully the next step will be some access to that system.
Jean, you've seen the new camp or a new camp. How do you think their lives will change, these asylum seekers, once they get to this camp?
Well, I only saw one camp on Sunday. It's outside of Thessaloniki. It's a huge warehouse. It must have been some sort of industrial facility. And now it's just completely empty with military tents set up inside. It's quite surreal. On the one hand, it did feel clean and very neat. And I visited with some of the refugees inside their tents. And I think there was an order there that maybe was pleasing to people. But at the same time, there were no NGOs there, no volunteers, very poor bathroom facilities, no running water. I can't really see a camp like that being a very long-time solution for people.
Jane Carstensen in northern Greece, reporting with support from the Pulitzer Center on crisis reporting. Thank you, Jane, as always.
Thank you, Marco.
One of the relief groups that's been working to help the migrants at the Idomeni camp is Save the Children International. Helle Thorning-Schmidt is the group's CEO. She's also a former prime minister of Denmark. She says she understands why the Greek government wanted to move the migrants out of the camp.
The conditions in Idomeni camp has been miserable, but what we're urging today is that the Greek authorities do this in a peaceful way and with dignity, and particularly that the vulnerable children that they're going to move are being moved in a considered and dignified way.
Do you have any reason to believe that the new camps will be better than Idomeni and with some degree of free movement?
Well, we definitely have reason to believe that the camps, the more formal camps, will be much better. But still, we have some concerns about the standard of the new camps. There are limited basic services, services like bathrooms and sanitation infrastructure in some formal camps that are not good enough. And what we are particularly concerned about is specialized services like shelters for children that are traveling alone. Children need safe places. They need to be able to be secure at all time. And we take child protection extremely serious.
You were, as I said earlier, the Prime Minister of Denmark from 2011 to 2015. Denmark actually right now is having a big debate about how far to go in helping refugees. It seems a lot of countries in Europe are. And meantime, few refugees are getting resettled from Greece to other EU countries. What does all this say about the way Europe is dealing with refugees right now?
Well, everyone has to understand that the situation is very complex. And of course, countries have the right to manage and secure their own borders. But we also have to see this from the ground where things are just not working. And if you look at the EU-Turkey deal, it doesn't seem to be a workable solution. Many families, including children, are left in a limbo in Greece and in the Balkans without a proper place for them to stay. As a result, the situation on the ground is that young children, pregnant women, and elderly people are sleeping in the rough. They're sleeping in fields and train stations for months and on ends. And I don't think that's an acceptable situation in Europe. So one of the things that I hope that European leaders will do right now is to put more resources into the humanitarian response on the ground in Greece. We need to make sure that refugees in Europe are treated with dignity and respect, and we don't need more paperwork. We need resources from European countries to help humanitarian organizations like my own to provide basic needs such as food, water, and medical care to these people.
So, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, you're there in Istanbul at the World Humanitarian Summit. Does it feel like the people in those Idomeni camps, for example, have top-of-mind recognition with the people who are at the summit? Or have you found yourself just wanting to stand up and shout, we need not just to fix this system, we need help right now?
Well, we need help right now, but we also need to think long-term. One of the issues that we're trying to raise as Save the Children in Istanbul right now is that we see a lot of refugee children that are out of school for a long time. If we look at Greece, which we're just talking about there, we have made a study that shows that refugee children in Greece have been out of school for more than a year and a half. And that is basically endangering their futures. So what we are campaigning for in Istanbul right now is that refugee children should have the right to not be out of school for no longer than a month. That will ensure that refugee children are not losing out on something so fundamental and something which is their right to receive a basic education.
Helle Thorning-Schmidt is the head of Save the Children International. She's been speaking with us from Istanbul. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Golf. It's an expensive sport and not known for its diversity, but in this next story, we're going to hear about a program in San Diego that's working to change that. The program is bringing young immigrants and refugees into the game and using golf as a way to help students excel in school. Jean Guerrero of station KPBS checked it out.
Zubair Muhammad is 12 years old. Today, he's giving golf tips to younger students, part of an after-school program called Pro Kids. It's had him out at the links 6 days a week for 4 years. He says he's also learned some life skills along the way, especially
patience and persistence. Honestly, you can't give up on anything, and at the same time, you have to be patient, because you can't rush to things, you know?
Zubair recently wrote a report for Pro Kids about how golf is becoming a more inclusive sport.
In the old times, mostly rich people and wealthy people wanted to play and said that other people, the common people, could not play.
That wasn't right, says Zubair. Why couldn't kids like him, whose parents are from Somalia, also enjoy golf? That's what Pro Kids is trying to do. It was founded in 1994 by Ernie Wright, an African-American caddy. He wanted to teach golf to disadvantaged youth, while also connecting them with academic tutors, scholarships, and trips to pro golf tournaments. He also fixed up a rundown golf course in City Heights, a heavily immigrant area of San Diego. That's where Zubair plays, and his game is getting pretty good, scoring 45 or less for 9 holes.
Now it's a sport for anyone.
The golf course is next to a Pro Kids Educational Center that offers kids tutoring. More than half of the 1,500 students enrolled at Pro Kids are immigrants or refugees. Zubair's mom, Maho Hussein, is a Somali war refugee. She says Pro Kids has transformed her son.
My son, he was chubby, he was frustrated after school sitting home. Now he is a very handsome boy.
Hussein says her son has lost weight since playing golf daily. She also likes that Pro Kids offers her son some structure while she's working 56-hour weeks as an elder care provider. And she sees the program's academic support paying off. Zubair is getting straight A's.
Since the kids play now, I felt like they achieve more. They've become very smart.
Keith Padgett runs the Pro Kids program and has a theory about why it works. He says children learn geometry and physics on the golf course.
It's all about angles, you know. Your swing is an arc. We have kids learning how different surfaces affect the rolling of the ball.
Padgett also says golf is the only sport where players must call penalties on themselves.
If that ball moves, you take a penalty. You call it on yourself. You don't need somebody over here to say you just violated a rule. You're supposed to report that.
Playing with Zubair is Nastejo Ali, a fifth grader whose parents are also Somali refugees. She says golf has helped her with math.
You get a number of strokes on a hole, and you need to add it up on your scorecard. And in school, I'm also doing addition, so it helps in school.
Her mom, Marianne Ali, likes this, even though she'd never seen a golf course before arriving in the U.S.
Oh, my God. I didn't know anything about golf.
But she tried playing recently, with her kids' help. They said her technique was off. She says golf isn't as easy as it looks. For The World, Jean Guerrero, San Diego.
Like this. See how that comes up? It's a very...
Coming up a bit later on the show, Phil Clay served in Iraq. He's now an author, and the war is always close.
I was a professional soldier and a professional military. I know what the mission was. I know what Iraq looks like right now. And it matters to me that Anbar province is not peaceful and secure. It matters to me, and there are consequences to that.
My conversation with Phil Clay and author Tim O'Brien, that's coming up here on The World. President Obama will be visiting the Japanese city of Hiroshima later this week, and one thing he won't be doing there is apologizing for the atomic bombs the U.S. dropped on the city in 1945. Obama has offered one explanation for that. He said that leaders make all kinds of decisions in the midst of war, and that it's up to historians to ask questions and examine them. So we decided to ask a historian what else won't be on the agenda when Japanese and American leaders meet this week.
They will not revisit history. They will not talk about President Truman. They will not talk about the decision to surrender.
That's Carol Gluck, a professor of Japanese history at Columbia University. She says Japanese and American narratives about Hiroshima and the atomic bomb differ radically, and that each misses something critical about what actually happened in 1945.
The story on the Japanese side is that the atomic bomb gave post-war Japan a mission for peace. And so the story of the bomb begins at the end of the war. In the United States, the story of the bomb is that the bomb ended the war and saved American lives. So the American story ends with the war. And one atomic bomb story is, if you like, a peace story which ignores the war that that was the reason for the bomb. That's the Japanese story. Mm. On the U.S. side, you could say that it ignores everything after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which would be the effects of radiation and the nuclear arms race and things like that.
The U.S. was crucial. I mean, it occupied Japan, helping it rebuild after the war. Did the U.S. also help Japan create that narrative?
This was a co-created narrative. Japan's war began in China with aggressive attack from 1937, at least, a total war. And so the Americans helped the Japanese write the China War out of the story, concentrate on Japanese-American conflict, and more importantly, concentrate on Japanese-American future. Mm. So yes, this was very comfortable for the Japanese. We can't forget that the Japanese people found this a comfortable narrative to look forward rather than back.
Do you feel both the Japanese and Americans have grappled with the moral ambiguity of their decisions? Have they both been able to be self-critical through these different narratives?
In fact, the moral question should really be raised about all civilian bombings where bombers would bomb indiscriminately and kill many civilians. Now, obviously, that moral issue has been recognized because in the various and actually numerous conflicts since World War II, carpet bombing, area bombing, that kind of indiscriminate civilian bombing has not been practiced. But when it comes to the atomic bomb, the moral question is very vexed, and the Americans don't deal with it. It was a weapon of war. It wasn't a moral question. The Japanese deal with it, again, in a prospective way. It's a moral obligation not to repeat nuclear war.
Has the moral issue been so focused on nukes that it takes actually pressure off all other non-nuclear bombings?
Yes, I think it does. In terms of history, the atomic bomb was the next new technology to continue bombing cities with. It was a new technology. It wasn't incendiary bombs, fire bombs anymore, but it was the same tactic. And so if you are talking about bombing innocent civilians by the hundreds of thousands, then I think you have to think about all of city bombings, as they're called, not only the atomic bomb.
So President Obama is going to visit Japan this week. Is this a time to try and reconsider and perhaps even do some repair work on how we tell these stories of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Not a chance.
You don't think it'll happen, but do you think it should happen?
It doesn't matter whether I think it should happen. It can't happen. It won't happen. They are really not going to revisit history. They've made it very clear on both sides in the governments. They are not revisiting history. They are making a symbolic statement, which is meaningful, about the hopes or prospects or policies for a non-nuclear future or nuclear-free future, as President Obama spoke about in Prague in 2009. So it's not about the past, except as the past gives a guidance or ought to give a lesson for the future. Politicians don't do history. They do memory. And if President Obama were to revisit it, our government would not have suggested or even permitted him to go to Hiroshima. And if the Japanese side wanted to revisit it, they would have had the same problem. So this is a symbolic meeting of the minds on an issue that one hopes everybody can agree on, which is nuclear warfare is something we should do everything we can to avoid.
If you could ask President Obama to break one silence during this trip to Japan, what would you have him address?
I'd like them both to break silence. I'll tell you how. This is not going to happen, so I will just tell you what I'm imagining, dreaming. I would imagine that the Japanese would say that we committed multiple acts of aggressive war and atrocities, which we will never again commit. In other words, Japanese put the war back in the story. What I'd like President Obama to do in my dreaming imagination would be to put the post-nuclear attacks part of the story back in, which, of course, is the suffering of those who suffered the radiation, the so-called hibakusha, the victims of the atomic warfare, and also the nuclear arms race. Now, he could actually do that because that's the position he's taken on nuclear warfare. But it's not a consensus in this country to change that bomb story about the bomb ending the war and saving American lives. So he can't do that.
You're basically asking for a new narrative from both Japan and the United States.
I'm asking one of them to start the narrative where it should, which is with the invasion of China on the Japanese side. And I'm asking the Americans to end the narrative, which is actually right through the Cold War and the arms race.
Carol Gluck, professor of Japanese history at Columbia University, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, let's spend a few moments hearing what happens when two narratives actually converge. Listen to this.
Water is life. Water is the foundation of life. It is life. There's no life without water. And the fact is that we're water. We're mostly water. That's what we know about it. We have the battle that's always between commerce and common sense.
Narrative number one, Joe Driscoll, born in Syracuse, New York, rapper and beatboxer, began performing at the age of 14. Narrative number two, Sekou Kouyaté, born in Guinea in West Africa, son of one of Guinea's most important singer-storytellers, or griots. Sekou grew up to be one of Guinea's most talented players of the kora, a multi-stringed West African lute. Joe Driscoll and Sekou Kouyaté met at a music festival 6 years ago, and they've been a duo ever since. The combination of these two stories, these two backgrounds, have led to a fusion that Joe Driscoll describes as putting baking soda and vinegar together. This is from Driscoll and Kouyaté's second album, Monistic Theory. We've got Driscoll and Kouyaté's live version of Stevie Wonder's Master Blaster up on our Tumblr. Gotta see that. That's at pritheworld.tumblr.com. News headlines are coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the Asian arowana. It's a designer fish that some people will do anything to possess.
There's been this spate of fish robberies where thieves will come and take the fish in the night. And I read about, you know, kidnappings and even fish-motivated murder.
One heck of a fish story that's still ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Vietnam and Iraq, two places where Americans fought long controversial wars, both in places that were culturally unfamiliar to most Americans, with vastly different climates from the U.S., and both conflicts that left deep scars. Tim O'Brien and Phil Clay each fought in one of those wars, O'Brien in Vietnam, Clay in Iraq. And through their talents as writers, they've provided readers with some of the most honest and raw perspectives of what it's like to go to places like that, fight, see really bad stuff, and come home. O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried, and Clay's Redeployment are standout pieces of literature about those two wars, both collections of short stories. Tim O'Brien and Phil Clay, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me just start by asking, have you ever met each other? And more importantly, have you read each other's works?
This is the first time that I've spoken with Tim O'Brien. It's an honor. Of course, I've read his work. You know, I think being asked to talk about Vietnam with Tim O'Brien to someone like me is a little bit like being asked to talk about enlightenment with the Buddha. So it's a real privilege.
And Tim, have you read any of Phil Clay's work?
I've been wanting to meet Phil for I don't know how many years now. We've had a couple of occasions where we nearly intersected. I remember one was at Stanford, and it's been a disappointment until today that I have not yet run into him. So what a pleasure.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. I mean, we're at this moment where the man who brought troops home from Iraq is now the third president to visit Vietnam. What thoughts occur to both of you at this moment?
Well, this is Tim, and on my part, I feel two things simultaneously, and they're nearly the reverse of each other. I feel great happiness that our president is in Vietnam and that relations continue to improve between our two countries. I feel immense sadness at the cost of the war, 3 million Vietnamese lives, and who knows how many grieving widows and fathers and mothers and sons and daughters. And that's not counting, of course, the 60,000 dead Americans. So there's there are competing feelings I have.
And Phil, you weren't alive when Vietnam was happening. What occurs to you as you see this kind of circuit being closed?
It's very strange. When I got out of the military, actually, I went to Vietnam. I was one of the thousands and thousands of Americans who now visit Vietnam as a tourist. Mm. And, this was in 2009. Iraq, at that point, it seemed as though it was much less violent than it had been when I first went to Iraq in January of 2007. And, I really hoped, walking through, the streets of Hanoi or going through Ho Chi Minh City and also seeing the museum to the American War there, that one day that would be a possibility in Iraq, that kind of normalization. And I think years now, it's, years later, I've been out of the military. I got out in 2009 for a long time. And we're still engaged there. There's still a tremendous amount of violence there. So those hopes certainly not realized. And I think, one of the things about confronting the legacy of war is that at the same time, you also have to confront the fact that we're still citizens in a nation that regularly uses military force. And we have to think about what that means.
Mm. I mean, it's not just how those countries where the United States has fought kind of recover, but this country itself. Tim O'Brien, what do you think the war in Vietnam is still doing to the psyche of the United States?
Well, it's easy to forget, but for every dead or wounded veteran, there's a mother out there somewhere in Florida or Mississippi who 45 years after the war, it hasn't ended for her. She'll still bolt awake at 3 in the morning and say, "Where's my baby?" And her baby's been dead 45 years. And the signing of a peace treaty and the normalization of relations and all the political trappings do nothing to comfort that 95-year-old woman or father or the child of that long-gone soldier. I think we have the illusion that wars end and that the cessation of hostilities. But as Phil knows from his war, and I know from mine, and soldiers from the Civil War knew from theirs, they echo on and on and on, way beyond the formal end of a war.
Phil Clay, you signed up for the Marines as opposed to Tim O'Brien, who was drafted. When members of the military discuss the draft today, veterans as well, is there a sense that a draft for young Americans making them part of national service as opposed to a volunteer military would be a good thing?
Veterans are conflicted about it. I think definitely one thing that you find among veterans of today is they're disturbed by the lack of engagement of the U.S. public with our wars. And I think a lot of times we talk about that in terms of the draft and the fact that, as Stanley McChrystal once said, the American public doesn't have skin in the game. At the same time, I think there's a lot of reasons why we aren't so engaged. We haven't had a new authorization of military force since prior to the Iraq War. We're still operating on that. There hasn't been a debate in Congress. A lot of the information surrounding what we do is classified. So there's a lot of things in place to prevent us from having to think too deeply about exactly what we're doing in terms of military strategy, whether we have sustainable goals. And it's one of the things that I think a lot of veterans, and particularly veteran writers, are concerned about. One of the things that they want to do is write about these wars, what's happening with the knowledge and perspective they have, just to open a space for more people to engage with it and think about it.
Tim O'Brien, what did being essentially told you have to serve in some way, how did that kind of affect the way you live the war and continue to live with it?
On a personal basis, I went to the war kicking and screaming. I was opposed to the war. I was from a small town in southern Minnesota and felt the pressure of middle America to do what your country tells you to do. So I was caught, but I was trapped, I felt, as between my personal conscience and the demands of my hometown and of my country. And there was no happy way out. It was either in some way or another evade the draft or go to Canada or go to jail versus go risk being shot in the head. And neither prospect struck me as a happy one, especially if you're opposed to a war, as I was. And I've been wrestling with that problem for now almost half a century.
Phil?
You know, I think that the moral questions of the war are very important. You know, if you signed up to serve your country, in many ways, that's an act of faith that the country is going to use your life well, right? You know, the 18, 19-year-old is not solely responsible to ensure that a couple of years after he's finished his training that America is providing him with sort of well-thought-out military policy. That's a collective responsibility. But when so few people are actually on the hook when that policy goes wrong, it's very easy for people to just kind of vote for what feels good or kind of empty political rhetoric. You're certainly seeing a lot of that in the current election season.
Let's talk about the distance afterwards, too. I mean, there are some examples of lifelong connections established, soldiers who married Vietnamese women or Marines in Iraq who took care of their translators. What occurs to you about life after war and kind of like getting completely unplugged from a culture that you were so deeply immersed in for several years?
Well, it's I mean,
this is Phil Clay.
Yeah. Civilian culture and military culture are very different things. And I think, you know, I think it's a strange transition, even for somebody who hasn't been to war, you know, to go from the Marine Corps to New York. And it's even more intense if you've been in a combat zone. I remember talking about the experience of flying home to New York from Iraq during my 2 weeks leave. And I didn't have a very intense deployment. I was a staff officer. But and I was talking about that experience with a combat photographer, spent a lot of time in war zones. And he cut me off. He said, "Oh, no, you should never go to New York straight after a combat zone. It's too weird."
Why? What was his point?
Well, because I know for me, I live near a combat hospital, so they brought in a lot of injured people from the battlefield. Sometimes Iraqi civilians, sometimes you know you'd have insurgents, Iraqi police, American Marines and soldiers. And I'd actually had the experience of seeing a Marine die in that hospital, and then I flew to New York and walked down Madison Avenue in the summer. And, you know, people are walking by in beautiful clothes. It feels there's just no kind of public sense that you're at war. Mm. It's just very strange and alienating. And you know that the political decisions that we're making here have life or death decisions overseas.
Phil Clay and Tim O'Brien, thank you both very much for being with us today. It's really been an honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Phil and Tim had a lot more to say than could fit in the show today. Catch the extended version of our interview on Twitter. Just look for PRI's The World. The most intriguing photo on my Instagram feed in the last 24 hours was from Vietnam, from writer and chef Anthony Bourdain. He was in a little Hanoi diner eating soup with none other than Barack Obama. You can't see what's behind the lens, but in front of it, the diner seemed pretty nonplussed by the leader of the free world having what they're having. The restaurant is called Bun Cha Huang Lien, and what those diners, including Bourdain and the president, were having was bun cha. I've got Michael Chong to tell us about this traditional Vietnamese dish. Chong is a chef and runs a restaurant called Elements in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. What is bun cha?
Bun cha is one of the oldest favorites of North Vietnam cuisine. The grilled pork, two style of grilled pork. You have more like brown patty and you grill them, and the other one is more like barbecue or pork. Mm. So the two style that you grill and you serve that with rice noodles. A lot of lettuce and fried herbs that are traditional in Vietnam, and a lot of nước chấm or broth that come with that.
That's a kind of a fish-flavored soy sauce, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Bun is pretty popular in most Vietnamese restaurants right after the pho. So the president had bun cha for dinner. Is that traditional, served as the evening meal?
Pho and bún chả, those dishes we eat all day long, whether for breakfast or lunch or dinner.
You would eat this for breakfast? That sounds pretty hearty.
Actually, yeah, if you see people eat this all day.
The total cost of the bún chả dinner with the president, according to Mr. Bourdain, $6 for two people. That's a great deal for us here in the States. But in Vietnam, is that pricey, bún chả?
Actually, it's average price in Vietnam for that type of restaurant. Bún chả can get a lot more expensive depending on the restaurant or the hotel that you go to.
What are your memories of eating bún chả in Vietnam?
I grew up in the South, and we do have a different version of bún chả. we call bún thịt nướng. It's similar to a version of bún chả. Tasty because the nước chấm or the broth is a lot more used in the north of Vietnam than the south.
So when I grew up in Chapel Hill, there was, I think, one Chinese restaurant, no Vietnamese restaurants. How did you end up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina?
I born in Vietnam, so escaped Vietnam in 1979. I was 15 years old. Hmm. And I got sponsored by the Catholic Charity of America, come to New Orleans, go to school in New Orleans. And then I fall in love with the cuisine and the cookings.
New Orleans is a great place to fall in love with food, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's very, very food town.
So we just spoke with two American writers who were in the military and write about the long-lasting effects of war. I'm just curious what part of the war still kind of is with you.
I'm more of a much younger generation now than the people that affect by the war because of the fall of Saigon that get me here. For me, I view the war is not much of a thing that I can do about it. The situation that get me here, what I can do with my talent to help American or the world know about the Vietnamese cuisines and to have the relationship between the American and the Vietnamese more understand each other, which had come a long way since I come to America.
Kind of a chapter in your life that led to another chapter in your life. Did cooking allow you to hold on to your Vietnamese culture, you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what the great thing about Vietnamese cooking or my cooking right now is that we have that Vietnamese and French fusion way back to the French colony, back in the early 15th, 16th century.
Right.
Yeah, I love what I do, and I really enjoy to bring Western and the Southeast Asia culture together.
Just curious if bún chả is on the menu today at Elements.
Actually, we have that yesterday, and we're going to run that dish for the whole week.
Wow.
You know, not all American people would understand what bún chả mean, but after yesterday, there's quite a bit of people.
They're interested. You know,
yep, and we sold quite a bit of it last night.
More than usual?
Oh, yeah.
Thanks to President Obama and Anthony Bourdain. You think that's it?
Of course, right.
Michael Chong runs the Elements Restaurant in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before the break, a story we're going to hear tomorrow on The World.
So they were really organized. They were sincere and genuine and really sweet.
A school principal in a Boston suburb okayed a student event, Hijab Day. Kids and their teachers could wear the Muslim headscarf in solidarity or just to see what it felt like.
The whole idea of it was to really develop empathy and to give voice to a minority group in our building that does not typically have voice.
Then the backlash began.
I actually cried. I actually was in tears because I was feel like we're already kind of in the 21st century, and I was kind of secretly hoping that people would be more tolerant.
We hear what happened to Hijab Day at Medford High. That's tomorrow on The World. Finding Nemo and soon Finding Dory. I doubt we'll ever see Finding Arowana. That's what this next story is about. A very sought-after species of tropical fish known as the Asian arowana. It's illegal to own one and expensive, up to $150,000 per fish. Some have even killed for one. So no, not really suitable for a kid's movie. Emily Voigt writes about the Asian arowana in her book, The Dragon Behind the Glass, a true story of power, obsession, and the world's most coveted fish. I asked her if I could actually pick up one of these fish at my local pet store.
Well, they shouldn't. If they have one, it's a problem because the fish is actually banned in the United States. It is an endangered species. It's protected by the U.S. Endangered Species Act. So you can't legally bring it into the United States as a pet. So if you find one, there might be a problem.
Right. Okay. So tell us what it looks like. I know there's several varieties of the arowana, mostly classified by color, right?
Right. So actually, arowanas are a family of fish, and there are seven different species across the tropics of the globe. But the one that's protected in the U.S. is the Asian arowana. That's the most coveted of the species. It is a tropical freshwater fish. And if you're picturing, you know, sometimes people hear pet fish and they picture something like a guppy or a goldfish.
Mm.
That is way off. It is not a small fish. It is, in fact, it grows about 3 feet long in the wild, so something the size of a snowshoe, basically.
Wow.
And it's a fierce predator. It is also called the dragonfish because of its supposed resemblance to the Chinese dragon. So it has these large, round, coin-like scales, and two whiskers jut from its chin. It kind of undulates as it swims, sort of like those paper dragons in a Chinese New Year parade. Mm. And, you know, that's the reason that it's become so coveted. It's believed to bring good luck and prosperity because of this association. And so it's been largely overharvested from the wild.
So you got a window into the dark world of this fish following a pet detective, and they do exist, not just the realm of Ace Ventura. You followed this pet detective into the South Bronx. What did you see?
Yeah, so I went on a alligator bust in the South Bronx. There was a guy with a pet alligator. Unfortunately, we didn't catch the alligator. It was long gone by the time we got there. But that is when I learned about the fish. I started hearing, you know, we were discussing about the different kinds of animals that come through the city that you wouldn't expect. And Lieutenant Fitzpatrick, the exotic species detective I was with, kept telling me about these fish that were sort of the bane of his existence, the Asian arowana.
And from that point on, you got interested and you went on the Asian arowana trail.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. At first, I was really hoping to turn up some big animal that you wouldn't expect to find in the city, and I wasn't that interested in pet fish. I kind of kept trying to change the conversation. But I went home and I looked up the species to see what I could find, and I was just floored because actually, while the fish is illegal in the United States, it's perfectly legal throughout much of the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world. And it's a legitimate luxury market, a bit like the art market. So especially in Southeast Asia, it's super interesting. That's where the fish is raised on farms that were likened to high security prisons. They have high concrete walls and barbed wire and Rottweilers prowling the perimeters at night. And the reason for this is that there's been this spate of fish robberies going back about the past decade or so, where thieves will come and take the fish in the night. And I read about, you know, kidnappings and fish-related canings and even murder, I would find.
Even
and
murder.
So I got, yeah, fish-motivated murder. So, yeah, I became super interested in where the fish was coming from and, you know, what had made it become this valuable commodity.
Has the trade and collection of the Asian arowana in Asia made it more endangered, more under threat?
Absolutely, it has. You know, when I first began researching the fish, I thought what I would find is that it had a deep history in Chinese culture or in various Asian cultures as kind of a mythological animal. But that wasn't the case. Only a few decades ago, this was like an ordinary food fish. It was something that people in the swamp were eating as an important source of protein. It's interesting. You know, in the 1970s, the fish was being overharvested for the food trade. And almost as a fluke, it got on the very first list of protected species put together by this treaty administered by the United Nations. It's called CITES. Today, it's one of the largest conservation agreements in the world. And so suddenly, the species was banned from international trade in the mid-1970s. And shortly thereafter, its price spiked. It became this coveted commodity. And there was a mad rush for the fish, and it was largely extirpated from the wild.
You learned also that celebrities across Asia love these things, wealthy people. Chow Yun-fat had one, and you learned that at an Asian arowana gallery. Where was that?
That's right. So in Singapore, which is the seat of the ornamental fish trade, you know, I happened to land there at a very great time. Aquarama was happening, and Aquarama is kind of like the Westminster Dog Show of pet fish.
Wow.
It is an international fish competition.
Such a thing existed.
Yeah. So, you know, pet fish show up from all over the world in their little plastic baggies to compete for prizes. And they're judged on, you know, color and body shape and deportment. You know, you want a fish with a certain kind of personality. And in the case of the arowana, you want it to be a bit aggressive and spunky. You don't want kind of a passive fish. And so that is where I started to kind of connect with high-end fish collectors. And, you know, some of the arowana generally sell for about, I don't know, think a few thousand dollars when they're small. But the prices go up from there. It's a lot like the art market. So the highest prices are, you know, $150,000. People
Wow.
say even higher sometimes. And I was determined to find out if there was, you know, truth to these rumors. And so I ended up traveling to Taiwan, where I met with a man who had made a fortune manufacturing toothbrush bristles, of all things. And he had spent $150,000 on his albino arowana.
$100,000 is one personable little fish, I got to say.
Right, right. And it can go belly up.
Yeah. Did you feel the passion that some of these collectors, especially in Asia, felt about the Asian arowana?
You know, it was a bit mysterious for me, I have to admit. First of all, I'm not really a fish person, or I wasn't in my previous life. And it's also a very male-dominated hobby. So most of the collectors are men, and especially of the arowana. Well, you know, it's true of the aquarium trade in general, and that is a very good question. There's a lot of theories about that. You know, maybe women like fuzzy animals and this and that. I don't know if any of that's true. But in Asia, at least, it's really treated almost like a status symbol fish and something that people often compare to, you know, collecting cars or something like that. It has a sort of masculinity to it, and a sort of the aggressive nature of the fish is valued. So maybe something around that. So I actually didn't start to feel like I wanted to own an arowana, but I did feel like I wanted to see it in the wild. And I became extremely obsessed with that. And I think that is really connected to why people keep fish in the first place. I think that there's really a desire to own a little piece of the wild, to experience wilderness, you know, so little of which is left.
Emily Voigt is the author of the just-published The Dragon Behind the Glass. Emily, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.